She knew it was true, and saw a great pit opening before her. "But," she began, not able to look either of them in the eyes. "Oh, there should be no buts, Tessa. No buts at all. You're not a prod. Both Billy and A know that." It was the older provo, Michael, talking. "What we'd like to know is what a good Catholic girl like you is doing regularly with a Brit killer soldier." This was still in the time when the lads tried to make people believe they were fighting a holy war, and it was Protestant versus Catholic. "Are you sure?" she began again, though she could see that these men were experienced and had no need to lie. "His real name is Ralph Docking." Billy, with the elfin face, sat still as a statue. Even his lips did not seem to move. "He's a captain in the Royal Marines, a commando, but on detachment to some other unit, trying to build up a little cadre of people here in the south. The kind of folk will give him information, spread tales, and feed stuff to the press. Illegal it is as well. Dublin hasn't authorized the gallant captain's little game, I'll be bound, and I'd be surprised if they even know he's coming over here regularly. Certainly the Gardaí don't know him. He's usually here of a Wednesday and again at weekends, but you know that." Billy shook his head, as though it were terribly wrong for her to know. "They bring him over by helicopter, drop him at a cottage up near Monaghan, where he keeps his car, for the drive into Sandymount."
"I think we should tell you what we want doing."
Once more, the older fellow Michael, sitting as still as Billy.
"You drive, Tessa."
"Yes, but..."
"But you have no car, we know that, so you'll hire one. You'll hire one this Sunday morning, and tell him that you've got a lovely surprise for him. You'll make sandwiches and stuff for a regular picnic. We'll tell you where to hire the car. Then you'll drive him to Glendalough, the Glen of Two Lakes, because it's a magical place, and a holy place. Have you been there at all, Tess?"
Michael did not wait for an answer. "Magical, with the remains of St. Kevin's Monastery, and those beautiful views. You'll give him his picnic, then you'll drive away and leave him."
"No."
Hand up to her mouth.
"No, no, I won't."
The tears were already scalding from her eyes. They did not have to spell it out for her to know what was planned.
"Keep your voice down, Tess. Don't be stupid now. You'll have everybody staring. Shush!"
"I won't do it. I won't."
She shook her head violently and felt the silent tears down her cheeks spraying off.
"For God's sake!"
"If you won't, then it's going to be a very painful life for you, with no kneecaps and the broken legs. For the rest of your life you'll live in pain, Tess, and it'll all be the same. Now you do as you're told, girl. Hire the car and do it."
Michael repeated the telephone number twice, just to be certain. That was where she would hire the car.
"It's best you pay for it, see? We'll reimburse you, mind, Sunday, right? Get there about 11 in the morning and leave before 2. Oh, Aunt Tessa, don't be foolish. Don't tell your man, no. Be your usual self, and we'll see you're looked after. Stupid things happen to stupid girls, so mind."
I can't. It's not..."
Billy stuck his little elfin face, with its pug nose and pointy ears, into her face and hissed,
"You'll do it, Tessa, or by the Lord Christ, we'll no way. Got it? You'll do it."
A little spray of his spittle crossed her eyes and nose, so that she lifted her hand to wipe it off, and Billy flinched, as though he thought she would strike him before he turned away. So they were gone, and she knew this was the end. There was nowhere to hide from men like this. She knew it, because she knew all the true stories. In the end, her love for Rory would make no difference. "That's all one," they would have said, in times gone by. She was desolated, half standing, then sitting back down again, for her legs had gone to jelly and her knees were buckling, and she knew she would rather be dead than do what they told her. Knew she could not do it, not in 1,000 years. She tried to stand up again in the whirling babble of conversation that went on around her, in the smoke and beer-breathed room. She had felt the blood drain from her face, actually felt the thick liquid blood leaving her face, knowing that her skin and flesh would look like old parchment. Tears ran down her face, and nobody appeared to be in the least bit interested. except for Jimmy McLean, who had started towards her from the bar. He reached out for her. "It's Tess Murray, isn't it?" And she felt his arm across her shoulder as he spun her around and propelled her towards the door. The chill evening air smashed her in the face, so that she reeled back, clutching at his lapel, sobs making her shudder. Tessa could never recall how he got her to his car, but she remembered the lights flashing by and even their arrival in Fitzwilliam Square. Later, she had a picture of them pulling up in front of the great row of red-brick Georgian houses, though in memory this always seemed to have happened by day. It was one of the great myths about Jimmy McLean. Everybody said that he had what they called private money. Later she learned that the only things his parents had left him when they died, in the terrible air crash outside Paris, was the beautiful Fitzwilliam Square house and a cottage up in West Cork, near Skibbereen. The money went to his sister, who, he told Tess subsequently, eventually loaned him a great tranche of cash to start his own practice. On that Sunday night, Tess wept floods of tears in McLean's kitchen while he made her sip neat brandy. She felt as though she were desperately ill, as if she should have been in hospital. All she wanted was to be nursed, looked after, cosseted. He asked her nothing in the house. Only later did he lead her outside and over into the railed central garden, the private preserve of house owners in the square, mainly doctors these days. Oddly, her memory retained the picture of the garden correctly. By night, with the high, ornate street lamps throwing unnatural light across the trees and shrubs. He walked her, sternly and with purpose, up and down, like somebody sobering up a drunk. When he spoke and questioned her, it was in short bursts. "No, it was the two men who came in and spoke to you, wasn't it? Tell me exactly what was said. No, this man, Rory Deacon. They say he's really a Brit officer. Royal Marines, is it?" And so on and so forth, until the whole story was out, including the depth of her love for the man whose real name was Ralph Docking, the man who was to be killed. She understood that. You did not have to be a genius to know what they meant to do at Glendalough. "I know those two, and yes, they're serious men. They're provos, all right," he said, speaking low, almost whispering. "I have a little influence. Not much, but a little. I can try, but I can do nothing for the Marine. He's as good as dead." In the end, he was not as good as dead. Tessa did not, could not, get a message to him. But she always wondered about Jimmy McLean's part in things. He told her to be strong and brave, picking her up 2 days later in his car as she left a lecture. Again, they walked in the garden. This time by day, and she took note of his watchful eyes, as if looking for an assassin lurking behind the damp greenery. "You'll hear no more from them. I persuaded them that you were innocent."
"I love him."
"Maybe, but you're innocent of knowing who he really is." Jimmy turned her around, as though an invisible barrier proscribed their walking space. "You're to forget about him."
"I don't..."
"It'll be hard. Nothing in life is easy, you know." A month or so later, she talked with Jimmy in a pub, thanked him, and asked how she could ever repay him, thinking he would want to sleep with her. His reputation was as a rottish fellow with the women. He wanted none of that, giving his little secret smile and telling her that he would think of something. Years later, he turned up on a wet Friday afternoon at her office in Belfast, as though appearing like the genie of the lamp in a pantomime, leaning against the door jamb in her office and saying they should talk, outside and away from the building. He drove her to the green hills south of the city, and still with a smile, told her about Alchemist and what her part would be. She asked him how he'd ever got mixed up in this, and noticed that his smile did not touch his eyes as he said, "Breathe one word of this outside of me and the man himself, and I'll see you dead in a ditch, Tessa." She knew he meant it, and never a day went by without her thinking about what he might have done for her, and what he might still do to her. In a way, she was in love with him, though nothing ever passed between them. The details never came into the open, though she was conscious of them lurking in the shadows between them, for the alchemist conspiracy they'd entered into immersed both of their lives in the end, and this was really only the beginning of it. If she could allow herself to see the whole business clearly, she would see the truth of it, that she'd been set up from the start, chosen as a suitable case for the job. But she rarely allowed herself to think about the manner in which she was brought into Alchemist's organization. And when she did, well, all the logic went to pot. If you thought it through, the dates were all wrong. It was far too early in time for Alchemist. But how many other little conspiracies was Jimmy into, even as early as that? It was here and now, on the day that Bex Oleska had followed Tess, undetected, in Dublin. Sitting in the old battered Rover, next to Jimmy, Tessa looked out on the raw, harsh and brutal beauty of the Wicklow Gap, and wondered at the enormity of the message Jimmy McLean was giving her to take to the man called Alchemist.